Sure, my energy will return as we dive right in. One of my favorite topics today. We're at module three. This is the last of our theory modules before we start, we have a break next week, and then we will start our seven practice modules. And we'll be spending 2 weeks on each of those practice modules with some built-in breaks as well. But I'm really quite excited to be sharing and having this conversation with you around what it means to be trauma-informed as coaches. So I'm just going to share my screen and we'll talk a little bit about what we're going to talk about. This is designed to be a really kind of interactive session. So there's going to be lots of opportunities for chatting and discussion and sharing. so please be ready for that. We're going to talk today about some of the principles of trauma-informed coaching. Whether or not you've had a chance to watch some videos or read the workbook for this module, this will be a bit of a refresher and a deeper dive into some of the material, opportunities to chat about it. Excuse me. So we're going to talk about some of the principles of being trauma-informed as a coach. I'm going to share with you Rupert's model around the three selves of trauma and why I'm choosing to use that, to share that with you. And we'll talk about how our clients may show up and how we may know that they're kind of in a survival mode, how we can get entangled with that, and how we can come back to our healthy selves as practitioners. And we'll do a little admin at the end, just on integration week next week and setting up your practice pods. Okay. And I guess I just want to start this session by saying, please don't think that this is a once and done conversation, that we're talking about trauma-informed coaching and then that will be it, right? That what we're doing in this module is kind of laying some of the foundation, and we will be coming back to this again and again over the rest of the program, looking at how we might work or how you may work with specific clients that you're already in conversation with, but also how to support yourself, what comes up, all of that will be part of our ongoing conversation. Okay. So some of the kind of principles that I think are quite helpful just to kind of hold in our hands as we're going into this conversation. Hey, Jane, nice to see you. The first is that one of the reasons we want to be informed about trauma is that for most people, the root causes of self-doubt will almost always touch on difficult, hurtful, or traumatic experiences, right? So this is quite important for us to kind of know that this is part of the gamut of doing this work. And I guess one of the things that I think is quite useful to be aware of is that the research suggests that adults in the UK, two-thirds self-report having experienced trauma in some form. And in the US, it's around about 70% across a range of different studies. So we're already working with humans that have trauma in their history. And I think that's helpful to know, right? Like, it's not like we can suddenly get prepared and do this perfectly. We're already working with clients who have trauma in their biography. We will continue to do that. A good thing to hold is that the clients themselves may not identify some of their experiences as being traumatic. Equally, they may never reveal their traumas to us. They may never tell us the details of them. They may just refer to them. We never quite know. We can never really tell from what our clients reveal to us where they are on their journey. We can't make assumptions about that. So I've worked with a lot of people who have had quite significant developmental trauma, like early childhood trauma. And they are coming to coaching. Most of them have come to coaching after a period of therapy, after figuring out some resources to help themselves, there's a level of self-awareness with most of our clients around the support that they may or may not need, right? And so for us, I think it is, it's always about a kind of active participation with the client. We're having a real conversation with a real human around their experience and what, and we're making some good scope of practice type informed choices about what gets to come up in the coaching conversation. Yeah. So just because someone says that this happened to me, it doesn't mean that that is going to be part of the coaching conversation. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that is relevant to what is going to come up. The way I see it is that we are talking about how can we resource their healthy adult self in the here and now, right? So we're sort of staying with the present state of the client. Another principle is that when we feel kind of at ease with clients' trauma, we're better equipped to help them to feel resourced, right? So when we kind of take in that information, 2/3 of clients, around 70-odd% of humans in the world, adult humans in the world, self-report some level of trauma. That may be high or low, depending on, you know, where you are in the world. But if that's true, then that means that people are more likely to have experienced trauma and to have developed some coping mechanisms that may or may not be helpful for them than they are not. So for us to go, oh, well, that is a normal experience. Sadly, that is a normal experience. Then we're less likely to create a container for our clients where they feel, oh my goodness, let me take care of you because you are now shocked with what I've told you about my world. We're able to hold it with them and be there with them. I also think that being trauma-informed really helps us to create a container of trust and safety for our clients. Like a lot of research around the talking professions suggests that the kind of number one indicator of a successful coaching, counselling or therapeutic relationship is the trust and safety that the client feels, is the relationship between the client and the practitioner. So the more we can kind of be with the client, be okay with what is coming up, the more that they are likely to experience that trust and safety with us, the more likely they are to get what they have come for to coaching. Yeah. And we're humans with coaching skills. So we all have our own traumas and coping strategies, right? And sometimes this is where we can get entangled with our clients because we all bring our own stuff. Right, this is very human work. And so part of our job, I think, is to take care of ourselves and our own situation. That is what helps us to be able to create that container. Yeah. I just want to stop there for a second and I just want to check in with everyone. If you think about how kind of equipped and perhaps confident might be the word to use, but how equipped, resourced, confident do you feel right now about supporting clients that may come to you with trauma? Do you just want to like put a number between 1 and 10? 10 being I'm totally fine with it, bring anything, I've got it. 0 being I'm not sure. Just feel free to share in the chat and that will give us a nice little. Cool. Yeah. So I would say most of the people this morning were a 2 or a 3. I was definitely a 2 when I started out and realized, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to get okay with trauma. I don't even really know what that means. Right. So all to say, sometimes when we share in groups, we're a bit like, oh, shit, I better up my number. Right. And that's totally cool. And I also appreciate, like, Colette, you have an enormous amount of experience as a counsellor and specialist training in this as well. So, and Ankur, I'm sure that this has been part of your history as well. So all to say, it's very understandable to be a bit kind of feel a bit unmoored when you start working with clients with trauma. What I would say is that almost, in fact, every helping profession apart from coaching includes supervision. Supervision is professional support for practitioners. If you are not in supervision, I highly recommend that you look to seek out a supervisor and interview some people, right? Don't just go, oh, you must be the right one. Like, seek out someone who can really support you. I think it is the number one thing we can do to professionalize our practice is to get a really good supervisor. They are going to be in your corner helping you to figure some of this stuff out, to work out where those entanglement dynamics might show up. I'm on a bandwagon to get every coach in supervision. I think it's so important. I've had 9 years. I think I'm entering my 10th year. I've worked with 3 different supervisors, so long-term relationships. One retired, the other one moved countries. So I tend to like those long-term connections. But having a supervisor is such a, I think it's the most crucial support you will ever get. It's way more important than a business coach. Okay. So just to say, supervision is definitely the support you can have to talk through specific issues that might come up around client dynamics, power dynamics, entanglement stuff, mirrored stuff where your client comes and brings their stuff and you're like, oh shit, I'm still dealing with that and I'm not sure how I can manage the two. Yeah. It's so important. So one of the things, the reason I kind of share that with you as well is I was really lucky to work with a practitioner called Julia Vaughan Smith for a while. Who referred me on to a really long-term supervisor that I had. And she is a psychotherapist and a coach, and she has just written a book called Coaching and Trauma, which is really helpful. She introduced Rupert's model to me about 8 or 9 years ago. And she actually does run some workshops on coaching and trauma as well. She's UK-based. And what that model, which I'm going to share with you, we're going to talk a little bit about now today, what that model showed me was that there is a way that I could hold the client's trauma without crossing over a coaching boundary and creating a space where both of us felt unsafe. It just gave me so much more scope to be able to recognize when my own stuff was getting in the way and when our conversation was going beyond the scope of my practice. Your scope of practice is really about a level of competency based on your training, your experience, what your sort of specialist knowledge is. And so we'll kind of sense that, oh, I'm a bit on the edge of that at the moment with this client in this conversation. And I think that is the thing to always bear in mind, that the sensitivity we may feel to different clients and different conversations is very context specific. I had a situation last year where someone brought something up in a session and I felt a bit blindsided by it because my own response was to go straight into my own memory bank and kind of, it was like, oh, I've realized I'm not fully okay with what happened to me. That's very close to what you're describing. So in the moment, it was about just taking care of myself, breathing, grounding, et cetera, being there for the client. And then after that, seeking out some support to look at what had happened, right? So even though, you know, I'm very experienced and have had all the support for ages, it's like, don't think there's a point where you kind of get to a place where, sweet, I'm sorted, right? And nothing will touch me now, right? This is human work, right? And human work means, you know, we're going to feel stuff and it's going to bring it all up. So I really want us to normalize and, you know, offer ourselves some compassion for when we get a little bit entangled with our clients. It's very, very understandable. It's completely normal to happen. We get frustrated with them and we get bored by them and we get triggered by them and all of that stuff can happen. And it doesn't mean that something has gone wrong. It just means something has happened, right? So, anyone want to share anything around just that stuff, how you're kind of feeling about working with clients that may have trauma in their biography? Please feel free to raise your hand. Yeah, Jane.
So this is maybe more a question. I tend to get people that have trauma, but they kind of talk around it. It's never about the trauma. It's just because of this trauma, here's how I behave. And so we kind of work that way. But the question that I had, it's something I remember doing in a workshop or experiencing that was related to trauma that kind of caught me by surprise. I was doing like a painting emotions thing and leading that. And I was trying to explain like my version. I was doing it with them. And then all of a sudden I just could not control my tears. And I was overwhelmed with sadness. And I was like, I don't understand where this is coming from. This is like, I had a boyfriend die, but that was like 10 years ago. And I'm over it. And then as they shared, like everybody had lost somebody. Like somebody had lost a child, somebody had just lost a spouse, and I didn't know that. And maybe this is maybe outside of other people's beliefs, but it was like I was taking on emotionally things I wasn't even aware of. And that I didn't know how to handle or to be more aware of.
You know, the first thing that came up for me as you were describing this, how incredibly powerful, like, you know, any creative form can be, right? Because it kind of takes us out of our brain that wants to make sense of everything, right? And just allows us to access something I think is quite magical, actually. I don't really understand it myself, but I'm here for it, right? That body and creativity and what we see, and I think color and painting, all of that, those unconscious choices we make to express something that wants to be expressed. Like it felt to me as you were describing, oh, you did that perfectly. Look, it allowed you to release something. It allowed you to cry. Maybe that was about tuning into some of the communal energy in the room, because that can happen too, right? We have that. Our energetic bodies are so much bigger than our physical bodies. So when you're in a room together and you're all tuned into that, who knows what you may be connecting to. But I guess one of the things that came up for me as you were talking was you used the word, oh, I didn't know how to stop that or manage that, the tears. Mm-hmm. And I guess, isn't that interesting that we think that's the thing to do?
Yeah, it was that piece of, I don't understand why I'm feeling this, like logically.
Yeah.
Because the only thing in my personal experience that I could relate it to was something that I didn't feel that strongly about. So then it was almost like once everybody else shared, and it took me, I would say even a day after, to realize, oh, maybe I was picking up on their stuff. And then it was almost like embarrassing that I was like, maybe it's related to this thing that I'm not that sad about. And then once they shared, and there's, you know, we like to put things in a hierarchy, right? So it's like, oh, well, yours was worse, or yours was more painful or more recent or whatever. So then it was almost like, embarrassing to have reacted the way that I did.
And yet loss is loss. Grief is grief. Yeah. I think that kind of experience when you're in a group setting as well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like, how do I want myself to be perceived as the leader? And how do I hold space for other people when I'm feeling the feelings too? It sounds to me like actually your people, the participants, had space to feel their stuff and to share their stuff. Maybe nothing went wrong. Yeah.
The other piece of it is I cry really easy, clearly.
Yeah. You're in such good
and company. I'm always trying to control it.
Yeah. Yeah, let it go. And it'll be interesting to see what happens if you just let it go, let it happen. Great experiment when we stop controlling. Yeah, we'll come back to what that can, how that can show up and why. Anyone else want to share anything about what comes up for you as we enter our little conversation? Yeah, Colette.
I was gonna say when I was kind of reading through the stuff earlier, it was, it kind of reminded me, in therapy terms, we talk about transference and counter-transference, and it kind of really made me think about that and like what's the client's and what's mine and how do we know the difference? And that's where the supervision comes in. It's like sometimes you have to take it to supervision and go like, I need to unpick this a bit, you know. So sometimes, you know, I've worked with clients before where halfway through, I kind of feel really nauseous. You go, geez, what's going on? Have I eaten something? Or is this me? Is that, you know? And then once it's finished, kind of go for a little walk around the garden and it's gone. And it's like, okay, yeah, I see what's going on here. There's something underneath that. So it's really paying attention to all the stuff, not just what's being said, but what you're kind of experiencing as well is quite interesting, and just kind of connecting with, is that me? Is that my stuff or is that their stuff?
And if it is my stuff, is it something I just need to feel, or do I need to figure it out, or do, you know, what happens now kind of thing?
Yeah. And quite often you can just kind of notice it and realize and then make a note of it and then kind of get a bit deeper into it. And sometimes if it really is your shit, then yeah, sometimes you need to have therapy even, you know.
Yeah.
So exactly. it's you know, you can have supervision, you can have therapy, there's lots going on.
Yeah. And I think I know when I was training, Martha Beck used to say, you know, coaching does no harm. And I think she has moved on from that thinking. But I think we should always be mindful of how our unhealed stuff, stuff we don't look at, will always come into our sessions. And we'll start to notice patterns. We'll start to see, oh, this kind of client really annoys me. Or I don't like working with these kinds of people. Or why am I exhausted? Paying attention to your experience is like the most useful way in to your own stuff. Let's talk a little bit about Rupert's model. Just a couple of caveats here, and this is in the workbook, but I just want to make this really clear. We're not going to talk a ton about the somatic experience of trauma, and other than to say it's useful to know that it's our bodies that will often give us information, give our clients information that something is being unearthed, right? How I want you to see this model, and I think the most helpful way to see this model is that it's a kind of metaphor for what happens when we've experienced trauma, right? And the thing to notice here is that there is this split that tends to happen. It looks nice and neat in the diagram, right, in the model, but it's always a bit messier than that. But I think the thing to always remember is that the healthy self of a client who has chosen to come to coaching is always going to be the largest part, right? I think that's a safe assumption to make, because that's the part that's bringing the client to coaching. That's the part of the client the client that has made the decision, it's coaching that I'm looking for, not therapy, not counseling, right? This is the context in which I can work with. And usually they've had a conversation with you before they start that relationship. So we know that they already feel some kind of affinity with you. The healthy self is the part of the client that is the most resourced, right? So it has access to imagination and creativity and joy and pleasure. It can show discernment, has a good memory, can practice self-compassion, access emotions, needs, all of that stuff that a healthy adult self would have, right? So it's really important to remember that that's the part of the client we want to be coaching. That's where we have a coaching relationship. And then there are these two other selves, these other parts of the client that will be smaller or larger, depending on the client's specific context and history. The trauma self, which holds on to the trauma and has the job of shielding the experience of trauma. So the trauma does not want to be revisited, right? It's actually trying to keep it safe from immediate consciousness. But it can also be a bit frozen at the age and the time of the trauma. So like I often think, I've probably got half a dozen little trauma selves at different ages that are sort of sitting in there. And sometimes I can feel like they want to be in charge to protect me. And that trauma self is almost never going to be present in the coaching conversation. Almost never, right? And the reason for that is because we aren't looking to provoke or have a conversation with that part of the client. The survivor self is the part of the client that we are particularly interested in, because this is what we will see in coaching, right? This is the impacts of in the here and now of the trauma that the client has experienced. Right. So in my case, I have a 14-year-old trauma self who was relentlessly bullied for about 6 months and had to leave a school. And that shows up in my survivor self, where I want to control the relationships that I have, particularly with women, because I'm trying to defend against that ever happening again. So you're quite likely to see my survivor self with a coach, but the what happened part, the part that has all the memories and holds on to that information, is not likely to come out. You're going to see the impacts of that, right? And so to coach me, you'd need to come back to my healthy self to see how can that part take care of that survivor, those strategies, what other choices might you have, right? So the way to think about the survivor self is that it's there to kind of defend against the trauma, to block access to it, right? It's protecting, like anything, against the risk of being re-traumatized. It's like a very pronounced protector, right? So if you think of the protector as a spectrum, then that survivor self is probably at one end, right? And the way that shows up is, you know, as we talked about in module one around the self-doubt loop, when you're contemplating a task, when our clients are contemplating a task that feel a bit risky to them, if their survivor self gets involved, that alarm is going to often feel quite disproportionate to the task they're contemplating. Might feel a bit illogical. They may feel a bit embarrassed even about the response they're having. It may feel like it's a bit overblown, right? Importantly, the survivor self isn't coachable, right? It's going to use a bunch of strategies. Almost always those strategies are about cutting off access to the body because that's where all the inconvenient feelings are. And it's not coachable. The only thing that happens when you try and coach a client who's in their survivor self is that you end up having a kind of war with the survivor, right? It becomes a bit of a battle, a bit of a tussle. You may have experienced something like that with past clients. Yeah. And the cool thing is we're humans with coaching skills. So we have our own survivor strategies as well, right? So the survivor self is very kind of in that fear-based place in the brain. It's all about keeping us safe. It's like a very pronounced protector. So it doesn't like to go in the body. I want to share with you the five main strategies that the survivor self is going to use. And I want you, as we go through these, to be thinking about your own strategies and those that you see in your clients, even in maybe your family members, if that's helpful to you. There's always someone who says, oh my God, I've suddenly realized why I can't have a conversation with this person in my family, right? So the first one is distraction. You'll see this in clients that use long narratives, lots of context. Let me tell you about everybody in the organization and why they're wrong, right? And this is all about distracting us from anything that makes us feel stuff, right? So we stay in explanation, stay in, building the picture. You'll also possibly get a clue to a client who uses distraction if they report sort of avoiding being alone or resting very much. They like to be on the move the whole time, because when you're alone, when you're rested, hey, guess what? That's when your stuff comes up, your feelings come up. So it's about being distracted from feeling, avoiding those feelings. In sessions, it can sometimes come up as a kind of confusion, right? Like when you ask a question, they're like, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I don't know how I feel. I don't know what I think. And it's a way of kind of shutting it down and distracting us, right? I don't know. I can't access that. So it kind of makes us, we get distracted then by the confusion, right? Let's move on. It's all about, let's just move on. Let's look at the thing over here. It's way more interesting than this. Right? And for us, when we use avoidance and distraction in sessions, usually it's because we're trying to avoid an emotion in our client that we find difficult to be with, right? Or we find our own emotions, sometimes helplessness, anxiousness, or being uncertain. Like, I don't know how to help you. I don't know what to do next. We'll do things like introduce a coaching tool. Let's use this tool and see what we find. Let's reframe that in this way, right? It's all about kind of moving along from being with the discomfort, right? Anyone thinking, oh yeah, I probably do that a bit, or I know clients who do that a bit? Yeah, cool. And so it's like, oh, that's helpful to know, right? This isn't the person trying to be problematic, difficult. It's not us trying to be, you know, not very helpful coaches. It's that we have this compulsion to just move on because being in the discomfort feels intolerable. Yeah. Control is a biggie. And this is bringing as much as possible under your control. And it's all about, if I can calm down any kind of internal chaos by having control, I'll be safe. Right. So you might see this in clients who like control aspects of themselves, their appearance, what they eat, what they allow themselves to do and be and have. You may feel controlled by a client, like someone who needs things to be a certain way or wants things to happen in the way that they feel is important. You will hear stories about how they like things done a certain way. Often it feels like, oh, and that's just what everyone wants, right? Like it's almost like an inability to see that there might be another way, or that the other person could be right or entitled to a different way. And if we want to use control as a strategy to manage our feelings of discomfort, we can sometimes try and control sessions, or we steer clients away from their own discomfort, right? Or we dismiss our own blind spots, right? The stuff where we think, as Colette was saying, we have that kind of sick feeling come up and we're like, I must have, it was the fish sandwich I had at lunch. That'll be it, you know? We dismiss it because actually it's kind of tricky to go, oof, maybe that was me, right? And we do things like not ask for help, supervision, support, you know? And even when we have those things, we don't bring the stuff that's really actually causing that feeling of chaos, right? So just because you have a supervisor doesn't mean you're telling them what's going on, right? It takes real courage to do this, real courage. Because we're going against the survivor self that's saying, no, this is what we've learned is the best way to take care of things. This is how we stay safe. The next one is compensation. And this is about finding some kind of escape, some kind of high, right? Usually we're sort of actually looking for some kind of substitute to that emotional or embodied sort of sensation and connection. So it can look like a client who eats excessively or drinks excessively, engages in things like sexual promiscuity or gambling, or scrolling, shopping, all of those kind of addictive-y type distraction behaviors. It's like we're seeking the high of something. Laughing at things that aren't funny is a really interesting one. I've seen this time and again where the person will reveal something and then they laugh. And you think, actually, that's not funny. That's really quite sad, or that must have been really painful. But it's a way of like, ta-da, let's move on, right? I'm okay with it. You don't have to take care of me. Let's not go there. Right. And I think that's usually because some of the behaviors associated with compensation can be kind of, we can feel some guilt and some shame around, sometimes some embarrassment, right? And often I think, and I know for myself, when I felt particularly lonely, just working on my own, you know, I've definitely used food as a sort of like comfort to that, rather than thinking, how can I seek out some support? And of course, you know, then you get the sugar crashes and you're not your most energized self when you're meeting with clients, etc. So all of that is just to say these kinds of compensatory behaviors are entirely understandable, particularly in our one-click existence, right, where we're very used to taking away any discomfort instantly. We like to do that. We're socialized and conditioned to do that. And it is definitely, if this is something that you're relating to personally, something that will really, supervision would really support you in. Because it's about looking at what's going on for you. Okay, we're nearly there. Illusions are about any kind of escape to a kind of idealized, simpler, easier, more perfect world. Has anyone ever said, let's reframe that into something more positive, right? Let's think about this in a more positive way. Let's think about what your ideal self would say to that. All of these kinds of techniques that we're shown and taught in our coaching programs, right? But what I found is that they're actually survivor strategies. They're usually about avoiding some kind of difficulty that's here and now, right? So the clients could gloss over their reality or cling to a sort of idealized future, right? They may idealize other people, right? Have illusions of, you know, their parents, their organizations, a colleague, a friend, celebrities, you know, people they admire that, oh, if only I was like them, my life would be simpler, easier, more perfect. And for us as coaches, it can show up when we're a bit uncomfortable with what the client has shared with us. And so we use positive thinking techniques to sort of gloss over all of that. This is, I think, what we're talking about bypassing. You know, when we talk about spiritual bypassing, which is such a kind of cliched term now, but it's really about avoiding the discomfort of the client's reality. When we do that, we kind of minimize and dismiss and invalidate what's real. And the last one is denial, right? Which is really just about refusing to acknowledge or kind of take in something that a part of us knows is true, right? So clients may be in denial about trauma, right? Especially if it has been caused or instigated, even unintentionally, by parents that they have deep love for. It's like, if I acknowledge that this is trauma, I don't know where this will leave me with my relationship with my parents. Right? It can also feel really vulnerable to share something that is really difficult. And it can also be about denying or being in a sort of like almost self-delusion where we sort of don't allow ourselves to acknowledge stuff that is objectively tricky, right? Things like, you know, I'm paid for a 35-hour week, but we work 60 hours a week here and that's fine. I work hard. And that's fine because everybody does. Or boarding school. This is comes up all the time. I don't know if anyone has ever coached anyone who's been to boarding school in the UK. It was fine. It did me so good. I made all my best friends there. We're all still mates. It's amazing, right? You start peeling back the layer and you see that boarding school is deeply traumatic for lots and lots and lots of people. Or things like my mother isn't, or my sister or my friend is in constant daily contact. And by the way, I've come to coaching because I don't want to be so much of a people pleaser. I want to find my own voice. But they're in constant daily contact. That's fine. That's just them. That's okay. That is outside the scope of my coaching, right? I don't want to talk about that. Right? So it's, and I mean, in some ways, it's like fascinating to me how we can almost, you know, quite willingly delude ourselves into what is actually happening, you know. And with us as coaches, you know, we can sense things are a bit off, but then we don't raise it with the client, right? We'll talk about it with everybody else except the client rather than just saying, hey, what's going on here? You haven't paid your bills. Or, you know, you didn't show up to your last three sessions. Let's talk about why that happened. We don't do that because we're like our survivor strategy, if it's all about connection and keeping people okay, taking care of people, it can feel completely at odds with that. No, we've been told that the best way to survive in relationship is to keep the peace, make things nice, don't raise conflict, right? So if that's a part of our survivor strategy, it can be really tricky to do those things. So we just deny that it's a problem. And we can also, I think, become pretty consumed with like the business side of things. I just need to get my marketing squared away. That's what's going to make me feel like I'm a valid and good coach, right? If I can get my website sorted, right? That will make me feel valid. Yeah. So it all makes sense, right? It all makes complete sense. And it's important, I think, to recognize that these are strategies that we use to kind of not look too closely at where we might be in survivor mode. Yeah. Where we might not wanting to be look at our past hurts and disappointments and traumas that have led us to believe that this coping strategy is actually a good thing or a useful thing. So I just want to pause there and just see what might be coming up as we've gone through those five survivor strategies. What's coming up for folks around perhaps the strategies you use, your clients use? What are you noticing? Yeah, Jane.
I have a question about the illusions piece. And I guess because I've struggled with confusion about like toxic positivity and spiritual bypassing, I don't feel like I have a clear grasp on like when you're coaching and you notice a pattern of like negative bias and helping them see a new perspective versus trying to do the toxic positivity or the like the reframe to positive. Like, is it just a balance of letting them feel that feeling, asking them questions to help them maybe open up to that possibility?
That's such a great question, because I think I just want to go broad and then I'll come back to this specifically. All of these survivor strategies help the client feel safe, help us feel safe, right? If someone took away my sense of humor that I have used for 5 decades to cope with quite difficult traumatic experiences, I would fall apart. And actually, I like that I have a sense of humor. Sometimes it goes a little dark, right? But it's that is part of a coping strategy for me that can be healthy. And sometimes it can tip into something that is not so healthy, right? And so the same is true for all of our clients and their specific strategies, right? There are all ways that we help create a sense of safety. But when we, instead of trying to coach with these strategies, when we actually engage the healthy self, there's more discernment, right? There's more resources available, more scope available. So it's exactly what you're describing at the start. I think you kind of answered your own question at the start. You know, is it about just giving a positive reframe, or is it about asking kind of more questions? Is it about doing, you know, a slight tweak in things? So for me, whenever we're working with a client cognitively, right, we're looking at what you might know as like mindset work or, you know, changing thoughts and things like that. The healthy adult self has to believe the thought, has to already be something that they believe is true. Otherwise, it's an illusion, right? So an example of that is from someone who goes, I'm disgusted by my body, right? And they are always just, you know, trying to control their body, and that's a thing that they bring to coaching all the time. You know, I just don't like my body. If you can go from that to the belief that I want you to change that to is I have a body, it neutralizes some of that, right? It's like, oh, this is my body, I have a body. It takes it out of that really unhealthy, unworkable, you can't coach with that, right? It's like, I'm not going to argue with you, okay? But instead, I would love you to practice getting to a place where it's just a bit more neutral, something that you can already believe. This is your body, you have this body, right? You might not want it, you might not like it, but can we both agree that you have it, that this is your body? And so it moves, it engages the healthy adult self, because then they can get a bit more kind of compassionate around the relationship in a very subtle way, right? Without bypassing the fact that you have a really problematic, difficult relationship with your body that has been, you know, translated through your mum's stuff and all your friend's stuff and the world outside. It's like, we're not going to fix all of that. But what we can do is come back to, where are you right now? You're in this body. do you see the difference between your body is beautiful and you have a body and this is your body? How much more grounded that is. So that's where we're at, is we're not trying to take away these strategies. We're trying to add more healthy self resources into these strategies so that are by design going to feel more meaningful and fulfilling and just better to the client over time. And that is going to mean that these survivor strategies are just less relied on, or that the balance shifts. Right, so they're using their laughter that has largely been developed by through trauma for positive means, right? Yeah, to actually support them and give them that lovely resource of a sense of humor at the ridiculousness of our existence. Yeah. Anyone else have questions? What's coming up for you as you're playing with these strategies? Yeah, Anka.
I just like to the lens of these different three selves to also know how I can listen, just mm-hmm. to listen. Because if I notice somebody's talking from the survivor self, I can talk to the survivor self of this person and really understand what their strategy is. And then to kind of validate that, to see, wow, that's where you're at. I totally get it. Like, that's very accurate, but amazing how, you know, like to validate how that is had survived. And then maybe to ask, maybe then also there's a chance to ask the healthy self, like, is this still the best strategy or is there another one? Like to first to really assess, well, it's a great lens for that, I think.
I love that you've picked up on that, Anka, because I think that's what I've found is so helpful about this, because it's a model that I don't often like explain to clients, right? It's something that I'll just have as a way of making sense of where they might be. But I cannot tell you the amount of times that just affirming someone's survivor strategy, as that makes total sense to me. That is working for you on some level. That makes total sense to me. How that the defenses kind of melt in that. Yeah. And you can imagine it right for yourself when you think about the survivor strategies you use and someone goes, oh, that makes total sense. Right? Of course. You're reminding me of a client I worked with a while ago, a young man of Southeast Asian descent who had just been promoted, and he didn't get on with his boss, but his boss's friend was an old colleague of mine, and that's how I got this referral, because I don't often work with men in corporate situations. But his big challenge that he revealed, really charming guy, really effervescent, had a real sort of energy time. I really liked him, and he was very likable, you know, and I thought that was interesting. Just right off the bat, you're very charming, interesting, good survivor technique, right? Be nice. But anyway, you start looking at people quite suspiciously after looking at this. But his big thing was he couldn't delegate anything, and he was close to burnout, and that was something that we discovered was a pattern in his life. He'd always worked very, very hard. And the question I asked him, and after he'd sort of explained what he was looking for, was I just said, oh, tell me about where you grew up. Like, are you local to London, or, you know, tell me about yourself. And he just started opening up, and he shared that at the age of about 9, he was the oldest brother he had a younger brother. His father left the family home quite suddenly, and his mum had a mental illness. His mum really struggled a bit throughout his childhood. So at 9 years old, he's the man of the house. He has all this responsibility, and he's desperate to keep his family together. he mentioned a few times, I didn't want me and my brother being split up or put in care. So he was excellent at putting on a front for social services and teachers. And he worked damn hard so that no one asked any questions about what might be going on at home. And he'd done that for his whole life. So no wonder he couldn't delegate. No wonder that was a really wrenching feeling of unsafety for him. And when I said to him, you know, I just really want to affirm that that must have been a really quite difficult childhood. You had so much responsibility. And he brushed it off. No, I just did what I needed to do. And I just thought, wow, that's so interesting, isn't it? Because my heart was like, oh, gosh, that's a lot. You know, and I just kept thinking about that little 9-year-old. And he was like, nah, I just did what needed to be done. And I was like, yeah, isn't that interesting that you're still doing what needs to be doing? And now, but now you can make different choices. If you want to, you can always keep the burnout. Like, I'm not here to take your burnout away from you. But if you wanted to do something different, you're really well supported to be able to do that now, you know. And it was like the first time he'd realized, oh, maybe this isn't me, right? Maybe I don't have to be the guy with all the answers, keeping every, you know, all the balls in the air. And you could see his whole body just changed in that moment. We worked together for about 6 months, and it was all about learning to feel safe and delegating. And it was tricky. It was hard for him. But he also, you know, sometimes it was like, no, it is up. This is up to me. But it was a conscious choice, right? So we're not taking away those survival strategies. We're just bringing in a bit more balance. It's a more healthy, mindful choice so that your life is a bit better. Yeah. Yeah, Anka.
So I just like that you bring up the staying with the issue. Like, Jane, you were looking into, okay, what do we do next? Yeah. And I think this is a thing that often is expected from us as coaches, and also from, like, we expect it from ourselves. Oh, now I have to show what I know, what they pay for. So, but sometimes I feel the best is really to have the patient and the space and the what is it, the patience to stay with what is, that they have the duration to really experience their state, and then often I feel it out of themselves the solution shows up. I could never come up with something that helps them, but they internally, they grow in the moment into the next kind of possible step or something. And I think that's beautiful to trust into, especially also based on this model with the selves, like to know, okay, they are in survival mode, and they are in this for a long time already, and they are actually ready to grow on there.
Yeah. And it's very much what we were talking about, like, last week, you know, that we're not actually trying to move the client on anywhere, right? Because where they are is where they are. It's fine, right? And we don't want to take away anything that they're not ready to let go of. But what we are there to do is say, you've got more choices now. You're a grown-up. You've got me in your corner. You didn't have me before, right? You've got some, we can look at some ways to figure that out, you know? So exactly that, Anka. It's very much about staying with where the client's at, you know? And, you know, I often think about this when it comes to, like, just the reality of marketing your business. You know, I mean, if we were really honest about marketing coaching, we'd say things like, I have no idea how long this is going to take. I don't even know if it's going to work, right? And I can't really promise an outcome. But what I can do is say, we'll figure some stuff out and you'll know more about you. And maybe we'll get to a place that just feels better for you. I hope so, because my experience tells me that that's highly likely, you know. But this whole idea of, like, come to 6 sessions over 3 months and you too will be healed, you know. It's like, you know, let's be real. So I just, all to say, like, I think once we start looking at coaching as a way of helping the client understand themselves better, you're exactly right, that healthy self comes in and is so creative. They'll come up with answers very quickly once the defenses down around, you know, having to worry about this thing that they're doing that feels okay, that being taken away, you know? Yeah. For this last part, I just want to do a little exercise and have you get into small groups. We did this morning and it revealed quite a lot of stuff for people. So I think I'm going to go with it. I'm going to feel my way into it. So I've just got three questions for you to sort of spark the conversation. So I'm going to ask those questions. You can write some stuff down and then take those into your small groups. So the first question is, I just want you to just bring to mind some clients or even just a person in your life that you find a bit difficult for whatever reason. There's tension between you or there's a sense of talking past each other. So they may be clients, they may just be people in your life. If you think of one to two people, that would be ace. And then just list a couple of bullet points for yourself. What assumptions are you making about that person? And, you know, be judgy, go to town. Have some off-brand thoughts. It's totally fine. We won't tell anyone. What assumptions are you making about this client or this person in your life? And then I want you to consider, like, what do you make this mean about yourself? That this tension or this thing between you is there. What do you make that mean about you? So now you've hopefully got just a little list of the assumptions you are making about this person or people, what you make that mean about yourself. And then for the last question, what else could be true? If you just read over what you've got, given what we've talked about today, what else could be true? So hopefully that's got some thoughts percolating for you. And we're just going to go into breakout rooms for 10-15 minutes. just to have a bit of a conversation about this. What we're really talking about here is kind of where we get a bit entangled with people, right? Where our stuff rubs up against each other. So let's chat about it. Make it normal. Okay, and I'm just going to put you randomly into one group of two, one group of three, and then we'll come back in about 15 minutes to just share and close up, okay? All righty. Oh, sorry. There we go. I think that worked. Yes. Hey, welcome back. How was that? What came up in your small groups? What else could be true about these difficult damn people? Anyone want to share? Love you to share. Give me something. I can't do it for us.
Oh, it looks like my microphone's off, so maybe it should be me.
Go for it. Okay. Tina, I'd love that.
Okay. I'm also the person that I hate uncomfortable silences, so that's me. I always jump in, even when I shouldn't jump in. It's bad.
I can kind of sit in silence, but after a while, people are like, what the hell is happening?
Well, I had a lovely conversation with Anka, and we kind of talked about our difficult friends, and it was just interesting, some of the themes about, you know, I think the third question, how do you make this about you, was how we, it kind of gives the responsibility back, because actually it's me that's upset, it's me that's reacting, you know, that person, they're kind of a negative neutral party, they're going to do that, but it's me that's choosing to react. And then the other one, what else could be true? We liked that because it kind of felt like permission or freedom to kind of maybe absolve, I guess, responsibility a little bit. Like maybe we could have a little bit of empathy for this person. There's things we don't know, you know, and maybe empathy helps a little bit.
Always.
And I think that's about it, Anka. It was interesting because we had two different people in different roles, but there was also some similarities and also similarities in the way we react. And I was saying, is that because we're both in the helping professions and we want to help? So it was good.
Yeah. Love that. Love that. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because when I always sort of feel like the folks that are annoying us, it's like, how many of us never even name it, right? Because we kind of secretly suspect we're being unreasonable or they are, and we don't want to name that, right? And what happens when you just go, oh my God, you're always late? It drives me nuts that you're always late. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring a book. Every time we meet, I'm just going to bring a book. And then I won't be pissed off sitting here feeling like I've got to go on my phone and worrying where you are. I'm just going to assume you're going to be 10 minutes late and I'll bring a book. Because I do want to hang out with you. I just hate that you're late. Right? And it's like, you don't have to change, my dear friend. Yeah. Love it. Love it. But they know then, right? Anyone else want to share what came up? Anyone have a client that they were like, oh, something's going on here. Don't like it.
Yeah, okay. I was thinking about a client that where you kind of think actually they didn't want to change. They're happy in their lane where they are and they're a bit stuck, and you know that it would be good for them to change. But sometimes I question, like, do they really want to change? And then it's like thinking about what does that say about me? Am I challenging them enough? Do I make them feel safe enough? And then it was like, what else could it be? Maybe they're just going at their own pace. Maybe we're just sowing seeds. And, you know, it's a slow, you know, and I mean, the one person I was thinking of is in her late 50s. So she's been a long time working the way she's working. So it's like, she's not going to change overnight. This is not going to be really quick work.
And even just naming it for both of you, how do you feel like the pace of change is going for you? And then like reassuring her the way you've reassured yourself. This might take some time. Yeah. I once worked with a person for a full year. She didn't make any significant change until the last month when she knew that it was up for, that was, the end was coming. I was like, I'm not going to be working with clients one-to-one after this. I've since gone back to doing that in some instances. But I was like, yeah, so we will be ending in a month. So what do we want to use that month for? Suddenly she had the motivation to go, okay, I'm going to do the thing that she'd been building up for, yeah, the best part of a year. It's like, thank God for the last minute. Some of us would never get anything done, you know?
And the other thing that I think we all collectively thought of is when I think it was Anka said that, you know, affirming where they are and then just questioning, is this still working for you? That's quite powerful.
Yeah, even just saying, you don't seem like you want to change, do you? You don't have to. It's no requirement. What has really, really helped me is to see difficult clients as clients in difficulty. Difficult clients are often as just as frustrated with themselves as you might be with them. And if we're both at them, it's really freaking hard to get a positive thing, positive outcome, really. Whereas if one of you can be in that healthy self of, oh, quite curious about what is going on here. What do you want to change? Let's take it slow. Where you're at, what if where you're at is perfect for where you are? And, you know, this really just brings me to this diagram, which is in the workbook. You know, coaching is always possible when we're in our healthy selves. Right? It doesn't matter if the client is showing up feeling, you know, something's happened and they feel activated in their remembering trauma. It doesn't matter if they're deep in their survivor self or if they're in happily their healthy self, right? When we are in our healthy selves, we can always coach the healthy self. We can always hold the space and allow the client the time and space to come back to their healthy self and feel resourced. So it's really important to pay attention to the tensions, you know. So like I said, this is not the only conversation we'll be having around trauma-informed coaching. But for me, this is like, it's like a raising your level of awareness, shining a light on those, particularly the survivor strategies that you notice in yourself and in other people in your life, including your clients. And just asking yourself that question, what might be going on here that I'm not fully aware of? You know, how, you know, if this is feeling uncomfortable, why is that? Is it mine? Is it theirs? How do I want to respond? It's very context specific, right? There's a lot of people that talk about trauma-informed care in quite a blanket way. And I think the more specific you get with that warm human being in front of you, the more you can see, you know, just what's playing out in the dynamic between you and how can you be of service to them in the best way. Yeah. Okay, so we have a integration week next week, which means no class and conversations. Before then, though, and the idea is that that gives you some processing time, rest time, reading, do nothing time. There is a practice pod special session with Scott on Thursday this week at 5 p.m., same time as the class. And that's about setting up your practice pod for success. And it's just basically, you know, sharing what we've learned over the years around setting up these small groups. You'll be getting an email in the next 24 hours with the members of your practice pod and inviting you to get in touch with each other and set up your first meeting. So you can do that either before module four or, you know, when you have a chance to. But the idea is you kind of know who your practice pod is, and you make some contact and set that up. And we're going to leave you to self-direct do that for yourselves. So that session is all about how to do that well. It will be recorded, so if you can't make it on Thursday, we'll send the recording out as soon as it's downloaded. And yeah, all to say, if you're feeling kind of semi-grounded in the theory modules and a bit uncertain about how all that's going to fit together in practice, that's exactly where I'm hoping you're going to be. Right. So it's the thing, isn't it, that you don't start putting all the pieces together until you've actually had a look at all the pieces, right? So yeah, offer yourself some compassion as you go through this. So please do feel free to continue on the conversation in the discussion forum, and we'll be back in class in a week's time. Not next week, but the week after, in time for module four. All right, lovely people, take care of yourselves, and I'll see you in a few weeks. Okay, bye. Bye-bye.